This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Les Misérables by Victor Hugo, translated from the French by Julie Rose and narrated by George Guidel.
As long as social damnation exists, through laws and customs, artificially creating hell at the heart of civilization, and muddying a destiny that is divine with human calamity, as long as the three problems of the century, man's debasement through the proletariat, woman's demoralization through hunger, the wasting of the child through darkness, are not resolved, as long as social suffocation is possible in certain areas, in other words, and to take an even broader view, as long as ignorance and misery exist in this world, books like the one you are about to read are, perhaps, not entirely useless. Victor Hugo, Hauteville House, January 1st, 1862. Part 1. Fantine. Book 1. A Just Man. Monsieur Myriel. In 1815, Monsieur Charles-François Bienvenu Myriel was Bishop of Digne. He was an elderly man of about 75, and he had occupied the seat of Digne since 1806. There is something we might mention that has no bearing whatsoever on the tale we have to tell, not even on the background, yet it may well serve some purpose, if only in the interests of precision, to jot down here the rumors and gossip that had circulated about him the moment he first popped up in the diocese. True or false, what is said about people often has as much bearing on their lives and especially on their destinies as what they do. Monsieur Myriel was the son of a councillor of the ex-parliament, a member of the noblesse des robes. They reckoned his father had put him down to inherit his position, and so had married him off very early in the peace, when he was only 18 or 20, as they used to do quite a lot in parliamentary families. Charles Myriel, married or no, had, they said, set tongues wagging. He was a good-looking young man, if on the short side, elegant, charming, and witty. He had given the best years of his life thus far to worldly pursuits and love affairs. Then the revolution came along, events spiraled, parliamentary families were wiped out, chased away, hunted, scattered. Monsieur Charles Myriel emigrated to Italy soon after the revolution broke out. His wife died there of the chest infection she'd had for ages. They had no children. What happened next in the destiny of Monsieur Myriel? The collapse of the old society in France, the fall of his own family, the tragic scenes of 93, which were perhaps even more frightening for émigrés watching them from afar with the magnifying power of dread. Did these things cause notions of renunciation and solitude to germinate in his mind? Was he, in the middle of the distractions and amorous diversions that filled his life, suddenly hit by one of those mysterious and terrible jolts that sometimes come and strike at the heart, bowling over the man public calamities couldn't shake, threatening, as these did, only his existence and his fortune? No one could say. All that was known was that when he came back from Italy, he was a priest. In 1804, Monsieur Myriel was the curé of Brignoles. He was already old and lived like a real recluse in profound seclusion. Around the time of the coronation, a small parish matter, who can remember what now, took him to Paris. Among other powerful persons, he called on Cardinal Fesch, Napoleon's uncle, to petition him on his parishioner's behalf. One day, when the emperor was visiting his uncle, the worthy curé, who was waiting in the anteroom, found himself in His Majesty's path. Napoleon, seeing the old boy give him the once-over with a certain curiosity, wheeled round and said brusquely, "Who is this little man staring at me?" "Your Majesty," said Monsieur Myriel, You see a little man, and I see a great man. Both of us may benefit. That very night, the Emperor asked the Cardinal what the curé's name was, and some time after that Monsieur Myriel was stunned to learn that he'd been named Bishop of Digne. But when all's said and done, what was true in the tales told about the first phase of Monsieur Myriel's life, no one could tell. Few families had known the Myriel family before the Revolution. Monsieur Myriel had to endure the fate of every newcomer in a small town, where there are always plenty of mouths blathering and not many brains working. He had to endure it even though he was the bishop, and because he was the bishop. But, after all, the talk in which his name cropped up was perhaps nothing more than talk. Hot air, babble, words, less than words, pap, as the colourful language of the Midi puts it. Whatever the case, after 9 years as the resident bishop of Digne, all the usual gossip that initially consumes small towns and small people had died and sunk without a trace. No one would have dared bring it up. No one would have dared remember what it was. Monsieur Myriel arrived in Digne accompanied by an old spinster, Mademoiselle Baptistine, who was his sister and 10 years his junior. They had only one servant, a woman the same age as Mademoiselle Baptistine, called Madame Magloire. Having been the servant of Monsieur le Curé, she now went by the double title of personal maid to Mademoiselle and housekeeper to Monseigneur. Mademoiselle Baptistine was a tall, pale, thin, sweet person, the personification of that ideal expressed by the word respectable, for it seems a woman must be a mother to be esteemed. She had never been pretty, but her entire life, which had been merely a succession of holy works, had ended up laying a sort of whiteness and brightness over her. As she aged, she had gained what you could describe as the beauty of goodness. What had been skinniness in her youth had become transparency with maturity, and this diaphanous quality revealed the angel within. She was more of a spirit than a virgin. She seemed a mere shadow with scarcely enough of a body to have a gender, just a bit of matter bearing a light, with great big eyes always lowered to the ground, an excuse for a spirit to remain on earth. Madame Magloire was a little old lady, white-skinned, plump, round, busy, always wheezing, first because of always bustling about, and second, because of her asthma. When he first arrived, Monsieur Myriel was set up in his episcopal palace with all the honors required by imperial decree, which ranked bishops immediately after field marshals. The mayor and the president of the local council were the first to visit him, and on his side he made his first visits to the general and the chief of police. Once he had moved in, the town waited to see their bishop on the job. Monsieur Myriel becomes Monseigneur Bienvenu. The episcopal palace of Digne was next door to the hospital. The episcopal palace was a vast and handsome townhouse built in stone at the beginning of the previous century by Monseigneur Henri Puget, doctor of theology of the faculty of Paris and abbé of Simol, who had been bishop of Digne in 1712. The palace was truly a mansion fit for a lord. Everything about it was on the grand scale, the bishop's apartments, the drawing rooms, the bedrooms, the main courtyard, which was huge, with covered arcades in the old Florentine style, and the gardens planted with magnificent trees. It was in the dining room, which was a long and superb gallery on the ground floor opening onto the grounds, that Monseigneur Henri Puget had, on July 29, 1714, ceremoniously fed the ecclesiastical dignitaries, Charles Brulard de Genlis, Archbishop Prince of Embrun, Antoine de Maigrigny, Capuchin Bishop of Grasse, Philippe de Vendôme, Grand Prior of France, Abbé of Saint-Honoré de Lérins, François de Berton de Crillon, Bishop Baron of Vence, César de Sabran de Forcalquier, Lord Bishop and Lord of Glendive, and Jean Soignin, priest of the oratory, preacher in ordinary to the king, Lord Bishop of Senez. The portraits of these seven reverend fathers embellished the dining room, and the memorable date of July 29, 1714, was engraved there in gold lettering on a white marble panel. The hospital was a low, narrow, single-story house with a small garden. 3 days after his arrival, the bishop visited the hospital. When his visit was over, he politely begged the director to accompany him back to his place. "Monsieur le directeur, how many sick people do you have in your hospital at the moment?"
26, monseigneur."
"That's what I counted," said the bishop.
"The beds are all jammed together," the director went on.
"That's what I noticed.
The living areas are just bedrooms, and they're difficult to air."
"That's what I thought.
Then again, when there's a ray of sun, the garden's too small for the convalescents."
"That's what I said to myself.
As for epidemics, we've had typhus this year, and 2 years ago we had miliary fever. Up to 100 were down with it at any one time. We don't know what to do."
The thought did strike me.
"What can we do, monseigneur?" said the director. "You have to resign yourself to it." This conversation took place in the dining room gallery on the ground floor. The bishop fell silent for a moment, then suddenly turned to the hospital director.
"Monsieur," he said, "how many beds do you think you could get in this room alone?"
"Monseigneur's dining room?" cried the astonished director.
The bishop sized up the room, giving the impression he was taking measurements and making calculations by eye alone. "It could easily hold 20 beds, he mumbled, as though talking to himself. Then he spoke more loudly. "Look, my dear director, I'll tell you what. There has obviously been a mistake. There are 26 of you in 5 or 6 small rooms. There are 3 of us here, and we've got enough room for 60. There's been a mistake, I'm telling you. You've got my place, and I've got yours. Give me back my house. This is your rightful home, here." The next day, the 26 poor were moved into the bishop's palace, and the bishop was at the hospital. Monsieur Myriel had no property, his family having lost everything in the revolution. His sister got an annuity of 500 francs, which was enough for her personal expenses, living at the presbytery. Monsieur Myriel received a salary of 15,000 francs from the government as bishop. The very day he moved into the hospital, Monsieur Myriel decided once and for all to put this sum to use as follows. We transcribe here the note written in his hand. Household expenditure. For the small seminary, 1,500 livres. Mission congregation, 100 livres. For the Lazarists of Montdidier, 100 livres. Seminary of Foreign Missions in Paris, 200 livres. Congregation of the Saint-Esprit, 150 livres. Religious institutions in the Holy Land, 100 livres. Societies of Maternal Charity, 300 livres. For the one at Arles, 50 livres. For the betterment of prisons, 400 livres. For the relief and release of prisoners, 500 livres. For the release of fathers of families imprisoned for debt, 1,000 livres. Salary supplement for poor schoolteachers in the diocese, 2,000 livres. Upper Alps Public Granary, 100 livres. Ladies' Association of Digne, Manosque, and Sistron, for the free education of poor girls, 1,500 livres. For the poor, 6,000 livres. My personal expenses, 1,000 livres. Total, 15,000 livres. The whole time Monsieur Myriel held the See of Digne, he made almost no change in this arrangement, but he called, as we shall see, taking care of his household expenses. Mademoiselle Baptistine accepted the arrangement with absolute submission. For this devout spinster, Myriel was both her brother and her bishop, the friend she grew up with and her superior, according to ecclesiastical authority. Quite simply, she loved him and revered him. When he spoke, she listened, and when he took action, she was right behind him. Only the servant, Madame Magloire, grumbled a bit. As you will have noticed, the bishop kept only 1,000 livres for himself, which, added to Mademoiselle Baptistine's pension, meant 1,500 francs a year. The two old women and the old man all lived on those 1,500 francs. And when some village curé came to Digne, the bishop still managed to find a way of entertaining him, thanks to the assiduous scrimping and saving of Madame Magloire and Mademoiselle Baptistine's clever management. One day, when the bishop had been in Digne for about 3 months, he said, "With all that, things are pretty tight." "They certainly are," cried Madame Magloire. "Monseigneur hasn't even claimed the money the département owes him for the upkeep of his carriage in town and his rounds in the diocese. In the old days, that was standard for bishops." "You're right, Madame Magloire," the bishop agreed, and he put in his claim. A short while later, after considering this application, the department council voted him an annual stipend of 3,000 francs under the heading "Bishop's Allowance for Carriage Upkeep, Postal Costs, and Travel Expenses Incurred in Pastoral Rounds." The local bourgeoisie was up in arms over this, and an imperial senator who had been a member of the Council of 500, promoting the 18th Brumaire and was now provided with a magnificent senatorial seat near Digne Township, wrote a cranky little private letter to the Minister of Public Worship, Monsieur Bigot de Prémenieux. We produce here a genuine extract of a few lines. "Carriage upkeep? Whatever for, in a town with less than 4,000 people? Travel expenses incurred in pastoral rounds? To start with, what's the good of them anyway? And then, how the hell does he do the rounds by post-chaise in such mountainous terrain? There are no roads. One has to proceed on horseback. Even the bridge over the Durance at Château Arnoux can barely take a bullock-drawn cart. All these priests are the same, greedy and tight. This one played the good apostle when he first turned up. Now he acts like all the rest. He must have a carriage and a post-chaise. He must have luxury, the same as the old bishops. Oh, these bloody clergy! Monsieur le Comte, things will only come good when the Emperor has delivered us from these pious swine. Down with the Pope!" Things were not good with Rome at that point. "As for me, I'm for Caesar alone." And so on and so forth. Madame Magloire, on the other hand, was delighted. "Hooray!" she said to Mademoiselle Baptistine. "Monseigneur put the others first, but he's wound up having to think of himself, finally. He's fixed up all his charities. Here's 3,000 livres for us, at last." The same night, the bishop wrote a note, which he handed to his sister. It went like this. "Carriage upkeep and travel expenses. Beef broth for the sick in the hospital. 1,500 livres. For the Society of Maternal Charity of X, 250 livres. For the Society of Maternal Charity of Draguignan, 250 livres. For abandoned children, 500 livres. For orphans, 500 livres. Total, 3,000 livres. And that was Monsieur Myriel's budget. As for the cost of episcopal services, redemptions, dispensations, baptisms, sermons, consecrations of churches and chapels, marriages, and so on, the bishop took from the rich all the more greedily for giving it all to the poor. It wasn't long before offerings of money poured in. The haves and the have-nots all knocked on Monsieur Myriel's door, some coming in search of the alms that the others had just left. In less than a year, the bishop became treasurer of all works of charity and cashier to all those in distress. Large sums passed through his hands, but nothing could make him change his style of life in the slightest, or get him to embellish his Spartan existence by the faintest touch of the superfluous. Far from it. As there is always more misery at the bottom of the ladder than there is fraternity at the top, Everything was given away, so to speak, before it was received, like water on thirsty soil. A lot of good it did him to be given money. He never had any. And so he robbed himself. The custom being for bishops to put their full baptismal names at the head of their mandates and pastoral letters, the poor people of the area had chosen, out of a sort of affectionate instinct, the one among all the bishops' various names that made the most sense to them. And so they called him Monseigneur Bienvenu. Welcome. We'll do likewise whenever the occasion arises. Besides, the nickname tickled him. I like that name, he said. Bienvenu pulls Monseigneur into line. We are not saying that the portrait of the man we offer here is accurate. We will restrict ourselves to the claim that it is a passing likeness. A good bishop for a hard bishopric. Though he may have converted his carriage into alms, that didn't stop the bishop from doing his rounds. Digne was a particularly exhausting diocese to tour. There was precious little flat land and a great deal of mountain, and there were almost no roads, as we said earlier. 32 parishes, 41 vicarages, and 280 branch parishes. To visit all of that is no mean feat. But the bishop somehow managed. He did it on foot locally, in a cart on the plains, and in a chair on a pack mule in the mountains. The two old women went with him. When the going was too tough for them, he went on his own. One day he rode into Senez, a town that was once an episcopal city, mounted on a donkey. He had been bled dry at the time and couldn't afford any other mode of transport. The mayor of Senez, who had come to greet him at the gate of the bishop's palace, watched him get down from his donkey, completely scandalized. A few good burghers stood around snickering. "Monsieur le maire," said the bishop, "and you, dear gentlemen, I see I've shocked you. You think it's terribly arrogant of a poor priest to ride the same beast that Jesus Christ rode. I only did so out of necessity, let me assure you, and not out of vanity." On his rounds he was giving and gentle, and he didn't preach so much as chat. He never represented a virtue as though it were beyond an ordinary person's reach. He never drummed up far-fetched arguments or examples. To the inhabitants of one area, he cited the example of the inhabitants of a neighboring area. In cantons where those in need were dealt with harshly, he would say, "Look at the good folk of Briançon. They have given their poor and widows and orphans the right to mow their meadows 3 days before everyone else. When their houses are tumbling down, they rebuild them for free. And so it is a place blessed by God. For a whole 100 years, they have not had a single murderer." At harvest time in villages where people were greedy for gain, he would say, "Look at the good folk of Embrun. If a man with a family finds himself at harvest time with his sons in the army and his daughters working as domestics in town, and he's sick and can't work, the curé offers up prayers for him, and on Sunday, after Mass, all the people in the village, men, women, and children, go into the poor man's field and harvest his crop for him. And they take the straw and grain and put it in his granary." To families torn by money worries and inheritance wrangles, he would say, "Look at the Devolny Mountains. A place so wild you'll only hear the nightingale there once every 50 years. Well, when the father in a family dies, the boys go off to seek their fortunes and leave the girls the property so they have a better chance of finding a husband. In cantons where people had a taste for litigation and where farmers went broke over engraved stationery, he would say, "Look at the fine peasants of the valley of Keira. There are 3,000 souls there. Lord, it's like a small republic. Judges and bailiffs are unheard of. The mayor does everything. He divvies up taxes, assessing each person fairly, mediates quarrels for free, distributes personal assets without charging any fees, hands down sentences without cost, and he is obeyed because he is a just man among simple men. In villages that he found to be without a schoolteacher, he also cited the case of Kera. "Do you know what they do?" he would ask. "Since a tiny place of some 12 to 15 households can't always feed a teacher, they've got teachers who are paid by the whole valley, who whip around the villages, spending a week here, 10 days there, teaching. These teachers do the fairs. I've seen them. You can recognize them by the quills they wear in their hatband. The ones who only teach how to read wear one feather. Those who teach reading and sums have two feathers, and those who teach reading, sums, and Latin have three feathers. Those last I mentioned are real scholars. What a shameful thing it is to be ignorant. You should do what the folk of Kera do." That's how he talked, in a fatherly fashion, gravely. If he lacked examples, he made up parables that went straight to the point, with few pretty phrases and lots of images, and with the same eloquence as Jesus Christ himself, sincere and persuasive. He puts his money where his mouth is. In conversation, he was affable and cheery. He spoke at the same level as the two old ladies that spent their lives by his side. When he laughed, it was the laugh of a schoolboy. Madame Magloire liked to call him Your Highness. One day he got up out of his armchair and went to find a book. The book happened to be on one of the top shelves, and as the bishop was fairly short, he couldn't reach it. "Madame Magloire," he said, "bring me a chair, will you? My Highness doesn't extend to this shelf." One of his distant relatives, Madame la Comtesse de Lau, rarely let an opportunity slip to enumerate in his presence what she called the hopes of her three sons. She had several very elderly relatives at death's door, of whom her sons were the natural heirs. The youngest of the three was to collect from a great aunt a tidy sum of 100,000 livres in bonds. The middle son was to step into his uncle's title as duke, and the eldest was to succeed to a peerage held by his grandfather. The bishop would listen in silence to this innocent and forgivable maternal showing off. Once, though, he seemed more dreamy than usual as Madame de Lau was going over all these successions and hopes in lavish detail. She stopped mid-sentence somewhat impatiently. "Heavens, cousin, a penny for your thoughts." "I was thinking," said the bishop, "about something strange that is, I think, in St. Augustine. Put your hope in him who has no successor." Another time he received the death notice of a gentleman of the district, which laid out in one long page not only the honors of the deceased, but all the feudal ranks and titles of nobility of every one of his relations. "What a broad back has death," he cried. "You can cheerily pile up any number of titles on it. And how cunningly people manage to feed their vanity via the tomb." He occasionally went in for gentle raillery, but there was almost always a serious message involved. One year during Lent, a young vicar came to Digne and preached eloquently enough in the cathedral. The subject of his sermon was charity. He called upon the rich to give to the poor and thereby avoid hell, which he painted in the most alarming colors imaginable, and to get to heaven, which he made out to be desirable and extremely pleasant. In the audience there was a well-heeled retired merchant, a bit of a cheapskate named Monsieur Géborand, who made 500,000 manufacturing serge and other kinds of coarse woolen cloth known as cadis and gasquet. Monsieur Géborand had never in his life given alms to those less fortunate than himself. But from the date of this sermon, everyone noticed that he gave a sou every Sunday to the old beggar women who hung around the door of the cathedral. There were 6 of them who had to share that sou. One day the bishop saw him performing his act of charity, and said to his sister with a smile, "I see Monsieur Géberon's busy buying a sou's worth of paradise." When it came to charity, he did not allow himself to be put off, even by a knockback. In such a case he would find words that gave pause for thought. Once he was collecting money for the poor in a salon in town. The Marquis de Chantercier happened to be there, a rich old tightwad who had found a way to be an ultra-royalist and an ultra-Voltairian at once, though at the time he was not alone in such a feat. The bishop came to him and put a hand on his arm. "Monsieur le Marquis, you must give me something." The Marquis turned to him and said sharply, "Monseigneur, I have my own poor." "Give them to me," came the bishop's reply. One day he gave the following sermon in the cathedral. "Dearly beloved brethren, my good friends, there are in France 1,320,000 peasants' homes that have only three openings, 1,817 homes that have only two openings, the door and one window, and lastly, 346,000 cabins that have only one opening, the door. This thanks to something called the tax on doors and windows. You put poor families, old women, young children, in such abodes, and just watch the fevers and diseases. Alas, God gives men air. The law sells it to them. I do not blame the law. I praise God. In the Isère, in the Var, in two alpine regions, the Upper Alps and the Lower Alps, the peasants don't even have wheelbarrows. The men carry cow dung on their backs. They don't have candles. They burn twigs and rope soaked in pine resin. It's the same throughout the highlands of the Dauphiné. They make bread to last 6 months. They bake it with dried cow dung. In winter they break the bread with the aid of an axe and soak it in water for 24 hours before they are able to eat it. My brothers, have pity. Look at all the suffering around you." A native of Provence, he had easily picked up all the different dialects of the south. He could say, "Eh bien, monsieur c'est sage?" "Hey there, mister, you behavin'?" as they said in the lower Languedoc. And "onte anarapasa," "morning, what gives?" as they said in the lower Alps. And "boart en bois moutou, ambre ou brun fromage gras," "a good sheep gives a good fat cheese," as they said in the upper Dauphiné. People appreciated this, and it was no small factor in giving him access to everyone's innermost thoughts. He made himself at home everywhere, whether in a humble cottage or in the mountains. He had a knack for expressing great things in the most common idioms. Speaking all tongues, he entered all hearts and minds. Besides, he was the same to everybody, the high and mighty and the humble alike. He was never quick to condemn, and he always took into account the surrounding circumstances. He would say, "Let's see how this sin came to pass." Being, as he laughingly described himself, an ex-sinner, he had nothing of the purest about him, and boldly professed, without the mad frowning of the ferociously virtuous, a doctrine that may be summed up as follows. Man is made of flesh, and that flesh is both a burden and a temptation to him. He drags it around with him, and he yields to it. He should keep a close eye on it, put the lid on it, repress it, and only give in to it at the last extremity. There may still be some sin in giving in to it even then, but such a sin is venial. It is a slip, but a slip onto one's knees, which may well end in prayer. To be a saint is the exception. To be a just person is the rule. Err, stumble, commit sin, but be one of the just. Sin as little as possible, that is the law of mankind. Not to sin at all is the dream of the angel. all earthly things are subject to sin. Sin is like gravity. Whenever he saw people indignant over something, rushing to get on their high horse, he would say, with a smile, "Tut, tut, this would seem to be a serious crime that everyone commits. The hypocrites are so shocked they can't point their fingers and duck for cover fast enough." He went easy on women and the poor, feeling that the weight of human society fell on them. He would say, "The sins of women and children, domestic servants and the weak, the poor and the ignorant, are the sins of the husbands and fathers, the masters, the strong and rich, and the educated." He would also say, "Those who are ignorant should be taught all you can teach them. Society is to blame for not providing free public education, and society will answer for the obscurity it produces. If the soul is left in darkness, sin will be committed. The guilty party is not he who has sinned, but he who created the darkness in the first place." As you can see, he had a strange, idiosyncratic way of looking at things. I suspect he got it from the gospel. In someone's drawing room one day, he heard a tale about a criminal case that was about to go to court. Some miserable wretch, for love of a woman and the child he'd had with her, found himself at the end of his rope and had gone in for a bit of counterfeiting. Counterfeiting was still punishable by death in those days. The woman had been arrested trying to pass the first false coin the man had made. She was held in custody, but they had no proof against the man. She was the only one who could point the finger at her lover and sink him by telling all. She denied his guilt. They put the pressure on, but still she denied his guilt. At that point, the public prosecutor had a bright idea. He told her that her lover had been unfaithful, and he managed to cobble together fragments of letters and so persuade the poor woman that she had a rival, and that the man was betraying her behind her back. She was immediately overcome by a fit of jealousy, and swiftly denounced her lover, admitted everything, offered proof. The man was lost. He was shortly to be tried in X, along with his accomplice. When the tale was told, everyone there was in raptures over the cunning of the prosecuting magistrate. By bringing jealousy into play, he had provoked the woman's rage, and the truth had shot out of her. He had brought about justice by sparking revenge. The bishop listened to all this in silence. When they were finished marveling, he had a question. "Where are the man and woman to be tried?"
"In the circuit court."
"And where is the public prosecutor to be tried?" A tragic event occurred in Digne. A man had been condemned to death for murder. It was some poor unfortunate who was not quite literate, but not completely illiterate. He'd been a tumbler, working the fairs as well as a public letter writer. The trial was the talk of the town. The day before the date set for the condemned man's execution, the prison chaplain got sick. A priest was needed to attend the prisoner in his last moments, so they went for the local curé. Apparently this curé refused, saying, "That's not my problem, not my job. Besides, I don't want anything to do with that circus monkey. I'm sick too. And anyway, it's not my place." When the bishop was told of this response, he said, "The Reverend Father is right. It's not his place. It's mine." And with that, he sped off to the jail, rushed to the cell of the circus monkey, called him by his name, took his hand, and talked to him. He spent all day and all night with him, forgetting about food and sleep, and praying to God for the soul of the condemned man, as well as praying to the condemned man for his own soul. He spoke to him of the highest truths, which are the simplest ones. He was a father, brother, friend, and only acted as a bishop to bless him. He taught him everything he could, reassuring him and consoling him as he did so. This man had been about to die in despair. Death for him had been an abyss. Standing, trembling on the ghastly brink, he had shrunk back in horror. He was not ignorant enough to be completely unmoved.
His sentence had come as a terrible shock, and had somehow, here and there, broken through the wall that inures us to the mystery of things and that we call life. He couldn't take his eyes off the fatal chinks in the wall, and what lay on the other side, and he could see only darkness. The bishop made him see a light. The next day, when they went to get the poor man, the bishop was there. He went with him and showed himself to the crowd decked out in his purple cape and with his episcopal cross around his neck at the side of this poor wretch whose hands were tied with rope. He climbed into the cart with him. He mounted the scaffold with him. The doomed man, so gloomy and horror-stricken the day before, was radiant. He felt his soul reconciled, and he trusted himself to God. The bishop embraced him, and just as the blade was about to fall, he said to him, "Whomsoever a man puts to death, God restores to life. Whomsoever his brothers chase away, finds the Father. Pray, believe, enter into life. God the Father is there." When he got down again from the scaffold, there was a look in his eye that made the crowd stand back. They would have been hard-pressed to say which was the most impressive, his pallor or his serenity. When he got back to his humble abode, which he fondly called his palace, he said to his sister, "I've just been officiating pontifically." As the most sublime things are often also the most misunderstood, there were those in town who said, commenting on the bishop's conduct, "Talk about laying it on thick." But that was parlor talk. Ordinary people do not view saintly acts with malice, and they melted with admiration. As for the bishop, seeing the guillotine up close had been a shock, one from which he was a long time recovering. The scaffold, when it is standing there tall and straight, can indeed make you think you're seeing things. You may think you are indifferent to the death penalty, can't say whether you are in favor of it or not, as long as you haven't clapped eyes on a guillotine. When you come across one, the shock is brutal and forces you to take a stand for or against. Some, like Mestre, admire it. Others, like Beccaria, abhor it. The guillotine is the ultimate embodiment of the law. Its name is retribution. It is not neutral, and doesn't allow you to remain neutral either. Whoever sees it quakes in their boots with the most mysterious of terrors. Every social issue hooks its question mark around this chopper. The scaffold is not a framework. The scaffold is not a machine. The scaffold is not some inert mechanism made of wood, iron, and rope. It is more like some sort of living being that has taken who knows what somber initiative of its own. You'd think that the framework could see, that the machine could hear, that the mechanism could understand, that this wood, this iron, this rope had a will of its own. In the frightened reverie into which your soul is thrown by its presence, the scaffold appears terrifying and somehow actively involved in what it does. The scaffold is the executioner's accomplice. It devours, it eats flesh, it drinks blood. The scaffold is a kind of monster manufactured by judge and carpenter together, a specter that seems to have a kind of ghastly life of its own, arising out of all the death it has dealt. And so the impression was horrible and cut deep. The day after the execution, and for many days following, the bishop seemed devastated. The almost brutal serenity of the fatal moment had vanished. But the phantom of social justice haunted him and would not leave him alone. He, who usually came home beaming with satisfaction after performing his duties, now seemed to blame himself. At times he talked to himself, muttering gloomy monologues under his breath. This is one that his sister overheard one night and wrote down. I had no idea it was so monstrous. It is wrong to be so absorbed in divine law that you take no notice of human law. Death belongs only to God. By what right do men tamper with a thing so unknowable? With time, his impressions faded, and probably were erased altogether. But it was remarked how the bishop from that point on avoided going near the square where executions took place. Monsieur Myriel could be called to the bedside of the sick and dying at any time of the day or night. He was well aware that this was his greatest duty and his greatest work. Widowed or orphaned families didn't have to ask. He came of his own accord. He knew exactly how to sit and keep quiet for hours at a stretch by the side of a man who had lost the woman he loved, the mother who had lost her child. Just as he knew when to keep quiet, he also knew when to say something. Such a wonderful comforter. He did not seek to efface pain in forgetfulness. He sought to elevate it and to dignify it with hope. He would say, "Be careful how you turn to the dead. Don't think of the rotting. Hold your gaze, and you will see the living light of your dearly loved departed up above in heaven." He knew how healthy believing is. He sought to counsel and to calm the desperate by pointing to those who were resigned, and to transform the grief that gazes on the freshly dug grave by showing it the grief that gazes up at a star. How Monseigneur Bienvenu made his cassocks last too long. Monsieur Myriel's inner life was brimming with the same thoughts as his public life. If you could have seen it close up, the self-imposed poverty in which the Bishop of Digne lived would have been a grave and moving spectacle. Like all old men and like most thinkers, he slept little, but his short sleep was deep. In the morning, he reflected for an hour, then said Mass, either in the cathedral or in his oratory. Once he'd said Mass, he breakfasted on a bit of rye bread dunked in milk from his cows. Then he got down to work. A bishop has a lot on his plate. Every day he must receive the secretary of the diocese, who is usually a canon, and almost every day his grand vicars. He has congregations to oversee, privileges to bestow, a whole ecclesiastical book tray to look into with the publication of missals and diocesan catechisms, books of hours and so on, pastoral letters to write, sermons to endorse, priests and mayors to make peace between, stacks of clerical and administrative correspondence with the government on the one hand and with the Holy See on the other. In short, 1,000 matters to tackle. The free time left to him by these 1,000 matters and by his church services and his breviary was given first to the needy, the sick, and the downtrodden. The time left to him by the downtrodden, the sick, and the needy was given to toil. Sometimes he took a shovel to the garden, sometimes he did a bit of reading and writing. He had one word only for these 2 different kinds of work. He called both gardening. "The mind is a garden," he would say. At midday he would stop to eat, and the midday meal was virtually the same as his breakfast. At around 2 in the afternoon, when the weather was fine, he would go for a walk in the countryside or around town, often poking into the poorest hovels. He could be seen ambling about alone, his head in the clouds, his eye to the ground, leaning on his long cane, snug as a bug in his warm quilted purple overcoat, purple stockings, and great clodhopper shoes, his head capped by his flat tricorn hat with 3 golden spinach seed tassels dangling off the corners. Wherever he appeared, there was a party. You would have said that he brought warmth and light wherever he went. Children and old folk rushed to their front doors to see the bishop, as they would run to look at the sun. He blessed and was blessed in return. Anyone who needed anything was shown to his door. Here and there he would stop and talk to the boys and girls and have a laugh with their mothers. He visited the poor whenever he had money, and when he had none, he visited the rich. As he made his cassocks last a very long time, but didn't want anyone to know this,
he never went to town without his padded purple overcoat. This was a bit uncomfortable for him in summertime. At 8:30 at night, he dined with his sister, Madame Magloire, in position behind them waiting on the table. Nothing could be more frugal than their evening meal. Though if the bishop had one of his priests to dinner, Madame Magloire took advantage of the occasion to serve Monseigneur some wonderful fish from the lake or some fine game from the mountains. Any curé was a good excuse for a good meal. The bishop went along with it, but apart from this, his usual diet consisted of little more than boiled vegetables and soup made with olive oil. And so the saying went in town, "When the bishop isn't feeding a priest, he's feeding a Trappist." After dinner he would chat for half an hour with Mademoiselle Baptistine and Madame Magloire before returning to his room and writing a bit more, sometimes on loose sheets of paper, sometimes in the margins of one of his folios. He was well-read, and rather erudite. He has left us 5 or 6 somewhat curious manuscripts, among others a dissertation on this passage in Genesis, "And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." He contrasts this with 3 other texts, the Arabic version, which goes, "The winds of God blew," Flavius Josephus, who says, "A wind from on high descended upon the earth," and finally the Chaldean paraphrase of Rabbi Unkelos, which goes, "A wind from God blew upon the face of the waters." In another dissertation, he examines the theological works of Hugo, Bishop of Ptolemais, and great-great-uncle of the Hugo, writing this book. And he demonstrates that sundry little tracts published in the last century under the pseudonym of Barleycourt should be attributed to this bishop. Sometimes, while he was in the middle of reading, and no matter what book he happened to have in his hands, he would fall into the most profound meditation and emerge only to scribble a few lines over the pages of this same volume. These lines often had no bearing on the book containing them. We have before us a note written by him in the margin of a quarto volume entitled "Correspondance du Lord Germain avec les généraux Clinton, Cornwallis, et les amiraux de la Station de l'Amérique. À Versailles, chez Poinceau, libraire, et à Paris, chez Pissot, libraire, Quai des Augustins." Here is the note. "O thou who art, Ecclesiastes names you the Almighty, the Maccabees name you the Creator, the Epistle to the Ephesians names you Liberty, Baruch names you Immensity, the Psalms name you Wisdom and Truth, John names you Light, the Book of Kings names you Lord, Exodus calls you Providence, Leviticus Holiness, Esdras Justice, Creation names you God, Mankind names you Father, but Solomon names you Mercy, and of all your names, that is the most beautiful." At around 9 o'clock at night, the 2 women retired and went upstairs to their rooms on the 1st floor, leaving him on his own on the ground floor until morning. Here, we really need to give you a more precise idea of the Bishop of Digne's abode. How he protected his house. The house he lived in, as we've said, consisted of a downstairs and an upstairs, 3 rooms at street level, 3 bedrooms on the upper floor, and an attic above. At the back of the house, a quarter-acre garden. The 2 women occupied the upper story. The bishop lived below. The 1st room, which opened onto the street, served him as a dining room, the 2nd as a bedroom, and the 3rd as an oratory. There was no way out of this oratory except through the bedroom, and no way out of the bedroom except through the dining room. In the oratory, at the back, there was an alcove closed off by a screen with a bed for the odd guest. The bishop offered this bed to country curés brought to Digne on business or to attend to the needs of their parish. The hospital pharmacy, a small building tacked onto the house and extending into the garden, had been turned into a kitchen and cellar. There was also a stable in the garden, which had once been the hospital kitchen and where the bishop now kept a couple of cows. Whatever the quantity of milk they produced, he invariably sent half of it every morning to the sick in the hospital.
"I'm just paying my dues," he would say. His bedroom was fairly big and fairly hard to heat up in winter. As wood is very dear in Digne, he'd had the bright idea of dividing the cow stable with a partition made of wooden boards and that way creating a sealed compartment for himself. And that was where he spent his evenings when it got really cold. He called it his winter salon. Like the dining room, the winter salon was very nearly bare, the only furniture being a square pine table and four straw-seated chairs. The dining room had the additional enhancement of an old sideboard mottled pink with distemper. The bishop had made the altar that decorated his oratory out of a similar sideboard and suitably decked it out with white doilies and imitation lace. His wealthy female penitents and the devout women of Digne had chipped in to provide a fine new altar for the Monseigneur's oratory. He had taken the money every time and given it to the poor. "The finest altar," he said, "is the soul of some poor wretch who finds comfort and gives thanks to God." There were two wicker prie-dieu chairs in the oratory, and an armchair also made of wicker in the bedroom. When he happened to have 7 or 8 visitors at the same time, the prefect of police, or the general, or officers of the regiment stationed in the garrison, or some students from the little seminary, someone had to go and get the chairs from the winter salon in the stables, the prie-dieu in the oratory, and the armchair in the bedroom. That way, he managed to collect up to 11 seats for his visitors. At each new visit, a room was laid bare. Sometimes there were 12, and the bishop would cover up the embarrassment of the situation by remaining standing in front of the fireplace, if it was winter, or proposing a turn in the garden if it was summer. There was an extra chair in the enclosed alcove, but half the straw seating was missing, and it only had 3 legs to stand on, so that it could only be used propped up against a wall. Mademoiselle Baptistine also had a huge bergère in her room made of wood that had once been gilt and covered in a soft floral pecan silk. But this bergère had had to be winched up to her room upstairs through the window, as the stairway was too narrow, and so it could not be counted among the movable furniture. Mademoiselle Baptistine's ambition was to be able to buy a lounge made of carved mahogany in a swan's neck design and with cushions covered in yellow rose print Utrecht velvet. But this would have set her back at least 500 francs, and since she'd only managed to save 42 francs and 10 sous for this object in 5 years, she'd finally given up the idea. Well, anyway, whoever manages to attain their ideal. You couldn't imagine anything simpler than the bishop's bedroom. French doors opening onto the garden, and facing them an iron hospital bed with a green serge canopy. On the other side of the bed, behind a curtain, toiletries that still betrayed the old habits of an elegant man of the world. 2 doors, one close to the fireplace, opening into the oratory, the other close to the bookcase, opening into the dining room. The bookcase, a big cabinet with glass doors full of books. The fireplace, its wooden surround painted to look like marble, usually without a fire. In the fireplace, a pair of wrought-iron fire dogs, decorated with 2 vases garlanded with flowers, the fluting once plated in silver, which was something of an episcopal luxury. Above, where the mirror would normally go, a copper crucifix that had lost its silver paint was attached to a threadbare piece of black velvet in a wooden frame that had lost its gilt. Next to the French doors, a great big table with an inkstand piled high with papers all in a heap and enormous tomes. In front of the table, the wicker armchair. In front of the bed, a prie-dieu borrowed from the oratory. 2 portraits in oval frames hung on the wall on either side of the bed. Small gilt inscriptions on the plain canvas mount around the faces indicated that the portraits represented the Abbé of Chaulieu, Bishop of Saint-Claude, and the Abbé de Tourteau, Vicar General of Agde, Abbé of Grandchamp, Order of Citeaux, Diocese of Chartres. When he took the room over from the hospital patients, the bishop had found these portraits, and he had left them where they were. They were priests, probably donors, 2 good reasons to respect them.
All he knew about these two characters was that they had been appointed by the king, one to his bishopric, the other to his living, on the same day, which happened to be April 27, 1785. When Madame Magloire took down the paintings to shake the dust off, the bishop had found this detail written in faded ink on a little square of paper yellow with age, stuck behind the portrait of the Abbé of Grandchamp with four sealing wafers. At his window hung an ancient curtain made of coarse woolen material that got so old in the end that, to save buying a new one, Madame Magloire was forced to sew a great big patch smack in the middle. This patch was in the shape of a cross. The bishop often called attention to it. "Doesn't that do you the world of good?" Every room in the house, upstairs and down, without exception, was whitewashed with slaked lime, just like army barracks or hospitals. And yet, in later years, as we shall see further on, Madame Magloire found decorative paintings on the walls of Mademoiselle Baptistine's chamber underneath the distempered wallpaper. Before becoming a hospital, the house had been an assembly hall where well-heeled burghers gathered together, and it had been decorated accordingly. The bedrooms were tiled in red bricks, which were washed once a week, with woven straw mats at the foot of the beds. For the rest, the place, being kept by two women, was always in a state of exquisite cleanliness from top to bottom. This was the sole luxury the bishop allowed. He used to say, "The poor don't lose anything by it." But we must confess that he still hung on to a few things left over from all he once possessed. These were a set of six silver knives and forks, and a big soup ladle that Madame Magloire loved to see sparkling gorgeously every day against the coarse white linen tablecloth. And since we're painting the Bishop of Ligne here in his true colors, warts and all, we must add that he was heard to say more than once, "It would be very hard for me to give up eating with silver." We should add to the list of silverware two big, solid silver candlesticks that had come down to him as part of his inheritance from a great aunt. These two candlesticks held two wax candles, and they sat as a rule on the bishop's mantelpiece. Whenever he had anyone to dinner, Madame Magloire would light the two candles and put the two candlesticks on the table. In the bishop's bedroom, of all places, at the head of his bed, there was a small cupboard in which Madame Magloire would lock up the silver cutlery and the soup ladle every night, though we have to say that no one ever took the key out of the door. The garden, which was somewhat spoiled by the rather ugly buildings we mentioned earlier, was laid out with four paths forming a cross centered around a drainage well. A separate path ran around the outer edge of the garden and along the white wall that enclosed it. Within the paths were four squares bordered with shrubs. In three of them, Madame Magloire grew vegetables. In the fourth, the bishop had planted flowers. There were a few fruit trees dotted around to boot. Once Madame Magloire had said to him with a kind of gentle malice, "Monseigneur, you are always so keen to put everything to good use, yet there's a useless garden bed for you." "Madame Magloire," the bishop replied, "you are mistaken. The beautiful is just as useful as the useful." After a pause, he added, "Perhaps more so." This square, with its three or four beds, kept the bishop nearly as busy as his books did. He would happily while away an hour or two, pottering around, pruning, weeding, and digging holes here and there to sow seeds. He was not as hostile to insects as a regular gardener would have liked. Besides, he had no pretensions to botany. He knew nothing at all about genera or other theories of classification such as solidism. He didn't give the difference between tournefort and the natural method a moment's thought. He didn't take sides either way in contests involving the Utricles versus the Cotyledons or Jussieu versus Linnaeus. He did not study plants. He loved flowers. He had a lot of respect for the learned, but even more respect for the ignorant. And without ever falling short in either respect, he watered his beds every evening in summer with a tin watering can painted green.
The house did not have